Why do some ideas take root and become prevailing wisdom, while others trend a minute and seem to disappear? The reason, we're told, is that ideas that stick are more compelling and easier to grasp than the ones that don't. But that's not quite true. I'm Makani Temba, an organizer, change communication strategist, and Black woman trying to get free. I've learned that what distinguishes ideas that root and stay with us, good or bad, is the structural and cultural power behind them. It's not about powerful narratives, though they help. It's about narrative power. This power is all around us, in our heads,
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9,
and hearts. It shapes what we think is true.
How Christopher Columbus discovered America.
What's fact? What's right? Narrative power determines the story of the past and roots and reproduces ideas over time. It's way beyond story. Join us as we stretch our understanding of what it means to build narrative power and explore ways to transform the institutions that shape how we, all of us, make sense of the world. Today, we're talking about pulp culture as a space for building narrative power and transformative change. I'm super psyched to talk with singer, songwriter, activist, and beautiful being Milk, whose music has inspired millions to reflection and action. Your breakthrough song, Quiet, became an anthem and rallying cry for literally millions around the globe. Please share a little about the song and what happened.
I wrote Quiet as my own healing song in end of 2015. So it was about a year before any rumblings of the Women's March was in the ether. And I wrote that song because I started going to therapy and really starting to question the narrative that I was telling myself that I had something wrong with me, and that I was the one that attracted the abuse in my life, and that I didn't deserve good things because of that. And that was a very subtle narrative that controlled a lot of what I did. And there were a lot of moments where, say, I'd go to workshops or talk to teachers or mentors, and they would ask me, like, think big for yourself, what do you want? And I would hit this ceiling in my mind, and I knew that there was something unnatural about it, because there's the part of my intuition that knew that I do deserve good things, but it was so buried underneath the narrative that I was telling myself for, I think, 15 years. And once I started to learn that what happened to me was not my fault, and that there's room for me to reclaim my voice, my belonging, my self-love, a flood of healing started happening very internally and privately with myself. And then it started flowing into my songwriting, and my songwriting started to address this idea of not keeping quiet. And when I wrote the chorus of the song, I Can't Keep Quiet, a one-woman riot, I remember feeling this sense of rebelliousness that really made me feel alive and, like, excited, because I had been told so many times, if you write the word woman in a song, or if you make it gender specific, you're going to cut out part of your audience. I had learned those in, like, how to write a hit song workshops, you know, and I said in that moment, I don't care. And it was like this micro moment of freeing myself from the structure that sits upon our society. And I felt alive. And I knew that this song was helping me heal, because I remember walking out of that writing session in Los Angeles. I walked out of the studio feeling this weight lifted off my shoulders and my neck, like, not being so tight. I felt like this loosening in my body. And I was like, okay, well, that was a gift for myself. And for the first time in my, you know, my mid-20s, I was letting go of this need to succeed with a song. It was just a song. It had to be, because I needed it to feel okay. So I ended up feeling this similar sense of rebelliousness when I watched our country elect Trump as our president at the end of 2016, and I felt a very parallel sense of rebelliousness. And I was like, huh, that's interesting. And I immediately thought of quiet. I thought quiet feels like my response to what is happening on the television screen. And when I saw the Women's March was forming, and there was this invitation for women and people who support women to march and express their dissent in a peaceful way, I was like, oh, I am in. And I didn't quite understand what I was doing, but I ended up deciding that I wanted to recruit a bunch of people to sing in harmony, because harmony for me has been really healing. Harmony for me is like, I sing a note. I trust myself to sing my specific note, and I trust someone else to sing their unique note. And then when we actively practice trust together, we create something beautiful. And as a survivor of abuse, trust is one of those things that gets broken very quickly. And maybe all humans can relate to that. But I thought, I'm so grateful for this march happening and people collecting. I want to serve and I want to give something. I don't want, I'm gonna just march and that's enough. And also as an artist, I wanted to provide something. And so I ended up recruiting 24 or 25 other strangers. I recruited them online. And I sent all of them links like to sheet music I made, recordings of my voice, and everyone learned separately, and then we gathered in DC before the march. And when we all sang together, we didn't know each other, but then after the song was sung, we knew each other in a deep carnal way. Tears were shed, and we ended up going to the march, and there's so many people, and we flash mobbed the song like 7 times. And then on the 7th time, this woman happened to walk by, and I didn't know who she was at that time. But I would soon become very close with her because she filmed our performance on her cell phone and posted it to her social media accounts. Alma Harrell is her name, and she's an incredible artist, activist, director. And over 2 days, the video on her accounts got like 8 million views, and it kept growing. And I was really surprised, because I had spent most of my life like doing things rather like unnoticed in a certain way, like pretty low key of a lifestyle that I had. And then when all that attention was coming to the song, I decided to put the sheet music up, and I decided to put all those recordings I had sent the original choir singers. I put it on a Google Drive. I posted online, hey, if you want to learn the song too, you can. And then within like days, or maybe a week, I can't fully remember, but choirs from all over the world started popping up and making their own versions, which was a whole like spiritual transcendent experience for me, because the resounding message for me at that time that I needed was, I am not alone. Because I felt so isolated in my grief and trauma. And then watching people use this song to talk about their own stories was a sacred experience. And I got an influx of messages of people sharing their stories of their trauma, how they've survived. And I thought it was really interesting that, you know, asking people to learn sheet music, to learn the parts, and to sing and to gather a community, that's like, it's not that easy of a task. It's like, takes a little bit of work. And I found that very interesting because I think when people are moved, they do want to do the work to be a part of something greater. And that's what I noticed. And so sometimes when people say, oh, you got to make the community building exercises easy, sometimes that's not true. Sometimes I think people want to go deep together.
I love that. That's a really, I think, a really important, I guess some people would say noticing. I think that cracks me up. But this idea of people being willing to go deep, that, you know, we don't have to underestimate people or softball it. That the, and people did, they really did. And you, like you said, globally, folks held the song close. And it felt like a moment of like power, like people going deep, but also powerful. And I wonder, in addition, do you have any observations about that sort of relationship between like what culture can do, what a song can do, and people feeling more powerful?
I learned a lot during that process because I wasn't very well versed in being part of, you know, global movements. That was like my first time. And I felt this initial and very young type of self-consciousness because I thought, oh, why am I getting all this attention? We have to work on our political system. And here I am doing these news articles and interviews. I was like, what about the activists that are doing the work on the ground? And actually our mutual friend, Marianne Manilov, she had reached out to me because of the video and we became friends. I happened to see her email and I just had this instinct, I had to call her. And I remember telling her, I was like, I feel this, I don't know, this self-consciousness, this guilt that I'm getting this attention when there's so much need to work on the actual policies and change. And she told me that movements need that emotional spark, and art has a way of really getting into the heart of a human spirit and being able to ignite this desire to be a part of something. So she said it, policy change and the activist side work hand in hand with the quote unquote softer sides of like cultural art statements, and they walk hand in hand together. And so that taught me a lot. And I started reprogramming because I think I still had some of that like capitalist like thinking that art is not as valuable, you know? And so I started to have to deconstruct that. And I see it very clearly now, especially after pandemic, seeing the role of art and how much it kept people going and brought people together and helped us communicate complex ideas about so many different movements that have swelled during this time. So I feel very certain that art and storytelling are an integral part of, it's like the fuel, I think, for the movements that we create.
Yes, Ashe, I love that. And it seems like you've built deeper on those ideas with somebody's beloved. And I saw how intentional you were around connecting with folks on the ground. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that process. Was it an evolution from where you started? Like what was it and what got you there?
Great question. I absolutely see the evolution from writing quiet and not quite fully understanding what I was doing. It was less intentional of like, I'm going to build a movement, because I didn't have that language. I was just, I want to do this. And if people want to join me, that'd be incredible. And then 3.5 years later, Somebody's Beloved, which is a song that really birthed after studying and reading up and being moved by Breonna Taylor's story and George Floyd, and then the countless other stories that unfortunately have been haunting our American U.S. history, and also igniting these really powerful movements of revolution. I had to do a lot of self-reflection to see what my role was in perpetuating the system that harms my black and brown siblings. And I realized, as an Asian American woman, my family was able to immigrate here because of Black activism and creating the immigration policy in the 60s that empowered my father and mother to move here. And my parents moved here without the context of what happened in the United States history. The main thought they had was they wanted us to survive. And so they taught us how to do what we needed to do to climb the ladders so that we could be safe. And so I realized last year that the ladders I was climbing were ladders that were built by an oppressive system. And if I kept climbing without understanding that context, I was causing harm to my Black and brown siblings. And so it was a big moment of, okay, I got to slow down and I got to question why I'm climbing these ladders. Sonia Renee Taylor talks about, you know, dismantling the ladders within ourselves, because that's all part of this like hierarchical system. And when she said that on this Instagram live video, I was like, you know, social media does haunt me so much, but this moment is very important. I learn a lot, you know. And I thought about that and I said, I have those ladders and I really want to look at that. And so when I wrote Somebody's Beloved, it's about my Black siblings in this world and what is happening and why aren't we all screaming. And then I thought, okay, I'm signed with Atlantic Records, and if I release this song, there's a profit structure that goes with it. That's kind of strange, because then where are the resources that are going to the song going when I'm singing about this matter? I was like, I feel like the resources need to be redirected. So then I thought, okay, maybe there's a way to create a fund, because I had already practiced that with Quiet. I created a fund with organizations that really lifted up feminine divine principles. I was like, oh, maybe I can do that again for Somebody's Beloved. But I have a lot of learning to do, because I am no longer, you know, with the Women's March, I am a woman, so I could speak from that place. But as a person who wanted to advocate for a community that I am spiritually a part of, but I am not, like, I don't represent the Black or brown communities, I thought I need to do a lot of listening and learning. And so I teamed up with you, Magani, and I teamed up with Marianne Manilov, who taught me a lot. And I teamed up with two women from Hawaii who were really passionate about helping me. They're called Benefit Partners. And we just started like researching all these different nonprofits. And I think for us was also a form of hope, because within the pain of that time in our country, we were looking at nonprofits and grassroots organizations that were doing work on the ground, and it gave us this sense of grounding and hope and inspiration. We're like, oh wow, there's so many orgs. So we have like this crazy spreadsheet of like all these orgs that we're looking at. And I remember going to you and asking you, hey, are there orgs that you love? And you were very thoughtful in teaching me, like, it spans with Indigenous cultures as well. And so that was very powerful for me to learn. And eventually I just started having more conversations and connecting, like real, taking the time to build more active community. And I ended up falling in love with seven orgs, and we created the Somebody's Beloved Fund. And I was told by some companies, like, or some advisors in the music industry, you should just really pick one so you can more easily brand yourself, so you can tell that story. And I understood that. However, I was like, what if that's just a thought in this current paradigm of this hierarchical paradigm? It's like, again, that one. I was like, what if we create an ecosystem of amazing organizations? And that felt more feminine, divine to me. Whether or not I can more easily brand myself or not, I didn't think that was important. And then, you know, with the rise of AAPI hate, I ended up bringing in three AAPI organizations because I realized I wasn't seeing myself and my culture within the healing of this movement. And that was a big part of this journey for me. And One of the organizations, Freedom Inc., they do Black and South Asian solidarity. And I thought that was really, really powerful. And they do that in Wisconsin. And they also do a lot of work with LGBTQ advocacy. So anyways, I just was really inspired. Now that community of orgs is actually interacting with each other, which is the coolest thing, you know, that now BEAM, which is Black Emotional Mental Health Collective, is collaborating with One Family Memphis, and they're exchanging information. So it's this cool thing that just is, we're just watching in awe. And now I'm at this next phase of, I just got a grant and I'm going to invest in another artist who has a vision to create more dance-oriented art to communicate solidarity and coming together and also accountability through movement. And so that's cool. Like, it's like, again, creating an ecosystem of artists who want to tell stories that then funnel those resources back to these 10 grassroots orgs.
I love that. And you know, I'm a huge fan of all the groups that's in and always have special love for Freedom Inc. Because I've been riding with them for a long time. You know, they're awesome, but all the groups. And I love this story around the developing of more connections, because that's also power too. And that's also how institutionalizing culture and thinking of alternative ways of how the resources get rooted and allocated and moved. So this is powerful. Blood on me. So thank you. I'm so grateful for you. I'm so grateful for your work in your heart and the story world. Has been just, told, you know, it was a great moment.
Why doesn't everybody scream? For anyone listening, say her name. Say her name.
Christina Mevs Apgar is the Culture Change Director for the National Domestic Workers Alliance, one of the smartest organizations about building narrative power I know. The Alliance uses just about every platform to advance their work and ideas. I'm so excited to nerd out with you, Christina.
Of course, I love talking about this stuff.
You know, a lot of times when people think about narrative and what's working, they always think about right-wing stuff. It was important for us to raise up the work that we're doing on in our, you know, as organizers trying to make transformative change. And you guys are at the top of the list. So thank you for making that time. So thought it might, would make sense if you talk a little bit around the fact that your title itself is not a title that often that you see in organizations, even though we do need them. And so you are the culture change director, right?
Yeah.
Can you say a little bit about that? Are you the first one?
Yes, at NDWA. And I had a title when I first started 4 years ago, creative partnerships director, that I think people like understood more, which now I realize when I say culture change director, I always need to follow it up with what that means. And when I explain it to the world, I say, basically, I do all sorts of things that intersect with pop culture, anything that our movement, domestic workers, domestic work, building movement, building progressive movement, anything within those spheres that enters pop culture, that's where I play. And then I list some examples. I say podcasting and arts and entertainment and cultural organizing, like murals and script integration in Hollywood and celebrity engagement, all sorts of things that seep into mainstream culture. So culture is everywhere, right? So if I say culture change, we're talking about, people could think that means my local religious community, that means the bowling alley. I mean, literally culture is all around us. So we try to keep it specific over here to what we mean, where we play, and we're playing in mainstream scale, bringing also niche culture into scale, into mainstream. and really playing for the hearts and minds and beliefs and norms and behaviors of everybody. And we're going to meet them there.
That's super powerful. And even though we know that works, right? I mean, I one of my experiences was with tobacco control. We had these, you know, monthly meetings with screenwriters in Hollywood. We, you know, did all these things, right? And so I love the fact that I'm watching you all do this and how you're holding it. I'd love for you to talk a little bit more about the strategy. You know, I know it's strategies intersecting and all of that, but just a little bit more about, like, you guys are you're digging in. Why is this important? And what does this actually look like?
Yeah, I'm really a big fan, and this is because I don't always come. I didn't come from the movement. I came from the other side. I came from the entertainment side in. So I love speaking in with examples that people can really wrap their arms around and be like, this is what this strategy looks like in practice. Like you said before, we have a suite of strategies over here at NDWA, the National Domestic Workers Alliance, everything from grassroots organizing to policy, state, local, even on the municipal level. We do direct membership, direct services. We build economic power. We have an innovations lab that builds a portable benefits platform. We play everywhere. And as a part of our narrative power strategy, it includes strategic communications, which most people, when they hear narrative power, they might immediately go to what is other words called strategic comms, which includes earned media, paid media, messaging, talking points, all the things that we think about, right? So that's super important. And we constantly are at the top of our game in that space. But we also mean other ways that narratives are passed along outside of traditional news media and outside advertising. So we mean symbols. So we think about design. We think about arts and culture. We think about messengers. Who are the trusted messengers in various spaces, whether that be a celebrity or an influencer or an artist or a small business owner? We think about who are the local artists creating local art in specific communities, and what sort of pieces of art can we create in public spaces that act as a convening point for our local organizers to engage on their local organizing campaigns. We think about the emergence of new platforms and mediums. We launched a podcast called Sunstorm, giving a plug to another podcast in your podcast. hosted by Jen Poo and Alicia Garza, two incredible women. And I've been so lucky to work with them. And we talked about how do women build power and stay powerful in a really chaotic moment where there was a lot of sun and a lot of rain. And how do you stay powerful and live powerfully in that? And we loved that experience. So we're constantly thinking of where can we go where people are congregating, and we'll experiment with anything. We will go there. You know, right now I'm watching the emergence. Okay, not the emergence. The emergence for me, because I was never into games, even though my husband spends time gaming, but gaming, you know, there's a reason that people are, more and more politicians are finding a way onto the gaming apps and trying to reach out to people there. So we'll go anywhere. and that's basically the base of our strategy is, where are the people? Where can we go to them? How can we speak to them in a way that they want to be spoken to, that they'll understand? And how can we shift beliefs, thoughts, and importantly, norms? How can we create a new norm?
That's what this series is all about, you know, helping people understand narrative power as more than just a powerful story, but just actually building power and also rooting and institutionalizing our stories so they continue to reproduce and recreate. So I love this. I have to ask though, are you guys about to do some games? Is that what's up? We're about to see some, you know?
I wouldn't go that far. Now, consulting inside gaming, just like so many nonprofits are in the entertainment world, specifically in Hollywood, consulting on film and TV, which is something that we do as well. That is something that we are looking into. How do you, you know, approach gaming in the same way you approach other pieces of content like film and TV, where there's incredible creators and animators and writers, and you speak with them and you create a feedback loop between artists who are creating pieces of content, again, at scale. So many people are consuming this. And how do we act as collaborators and partners? And we are connected to our base that we are accountable to. And so we act as that bridge. So more and more, I feel like nonprofits, we need to look at games. We need to look in places that we might have not been before or yet, and start building those connections and building that those bridges. So I'm always scanning. I feel like we always need to scan.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I remember movements back in the late 90s and early part of 2000s to try to deal with representation, obviously, because that's an issue. And even in this journey to do this work and this and our cartoon and the other things that are coming out as part of this project, we met actors who are in the gaming world who are also part of this conversation, who are pushing and trying to advance for less stereotypes, more layers, and also trying to figure out how gaming can contribute to greater imagination of what's next, which I'm excited about. I'm loving meeting some of these folks. So I'm hoping we'll get a chance to talk to them actually as part of this series. So
I love that. I will listen to that episode.
That. There we go. We're going to see if we can make that happen. We're still trying to schedule that. So we put the good juju out. And speaking of figuring out how to do things differently and working with around the film and entertainment industry, I would love if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about this amazing, I thought, amazing project in 2018, where you guys basically took over the Golden Globes, you know, had a big chunk of the Oscars, and it's sort of like award shows. What? I love it. And I'm just curious if you could talk a little bit about the campaign, what you were hoping to do, what you think you got out of it. And of course, a little bit for folks who aren't familiar what it was.
I'm assuming you're talking about Roma, right? About
the yes, it was yeah, Roma, but it felt like it was so much, it got bigger it was, than Roma.
It was, yeah. I asked because NDWA was also on the red carpet. Sounds crazy to be like, we were on the red carpet multiple times with Time's Up, and domestic workers were very active in the Me Too movement, which was another culture shift and culture change narrative power moment. So Roma was definitely my baby. And if a podcast also included visuals, you would see behind me, I have an incredible poster that reminds me, it's over my shoulder, that I always like to look at. And it reminds me of kind of the power of story and the power of taking story and using it to create, as iGen says, create the space in people's imaginations to progress further. So we have had a great relationship with Participant, the production company. They are incredible people. And there's a woman, Nicole Starr, over there who works on their social impact. There are not a ton of entertainment companies that are so intentional about how social impact is built into their work. So they're from the beginning. So she gave me a call that summer, the summer before the campaign, and said, hey, we have this film. I can't tell you what it is. I can't tell you really anything about it other than it's Alfonso Cuarón and there's a domestic worker in it. And I said, okay. And it was at this point, Alfonso had only shared the script. It was done filming, but before they filmed, he had only shared the script, I believe, just with the CEO of Participant, David Lindy, no one else. I mean, this was his baby. This was the most personal film he'd ever written, which was a love letter to one of the women who raised him in addition to his mother, Cleo. Well, Cleo is the name of the protagonist in the story, his nanny who helped raise him and really was instrumental in his life was named Libo. So that's all she could tell me. I said, yes, let's do a campaign. Started rattling off tactics. I had no idea what was possible. And then a follow-up call said, do you all want to come to the Venice Film Festival and in Italy and see the film? Alfonso would like to personally invite iGen, one of your domestic worker leaders. And we went there, and we'll never forget one of our leaders from Texas walking out of the premiere after seeing it. Her face was just kind of overwhelmed. And she said, that was me. That was my story. And it was beautiful. And then also iGen, her face, just, you could see the moment that this was a film that an Indigenous domestic worker was not only like a central protagonist, but it was her story in a holistic, nuanced, I mean, they showed a love story. They showed, you know, a complicated friendship and, you know, everything. Like, it was her, it was a whole human, and it was beautiful. And so from the moment we came back, we said, we're going big. So we built a huge social impact campaign. Our partners in it were participant. The film was distributed by Netflix. They were very supportive of our work. And we were incredibly proactive. We built the campaign. We made it work for our campaigns and for our agenda and for our important short-term policy gains that we needed. So the timing was perfect. We were just about to introduce our National Domestic Worker Bill of Rights, which was co-sponsored by now VP Harris and Congresswoman Jayapal. And so we used the film. We had a screening in DC, and we invited, you know, Congress members and created a big moment out of it. We held 19 community-based screenings across the country for affiliates and chapters where domestic workers and their communities could come and watch the film. I like to say we had two campaigns in one. One was for domestic workers. And the end goal was literally to see yourself, to feel empowered by that, to feel moved by that, to feel challenged by that. And then to have our local grassroots chapters and affiliates use that congregation to organize, to build power. One of my organizers in New Jersey years later said, you know, we wouldn't be introducing our New Jersey Bill of Rights if it wasn't for the Roma screening in Newark, New Jersey. I said, what are you talking about? And he said, yeah, that was the first time we all got together, all the New Jersey groups, and we all worked together and like co-labored, and it built trust. And then we kept talking to one another. And I was like, whoa, that's cool. That's like using a product for organizing directly. And then the second campaign was for audiences that were non-impacted, either employers or just to build solidarity, education. And we had a robust digital campaign. We had a website. We did PSAs. Alfonso did a PSA for us. We had huge like social media pushes. And then our big tent post event. And also domestic workers were at every official event. Like if there was a Roma premiere, there were domestic workers on the red carpet at the Netflix, like at the actual premiere in LA. Alfonso actually introduced iGen to give a pitch, which was incredible. And our biggest thing was our Oscar party. We said, we're going to have an Oscar party. It's going to be on par with all the other cool Oscar parties that go on in LA. It is going to be for, by, centering domestic workers. We called it the Heroines in Our Home. And it was huge. We had A-list celebrities on our red carpet alongside our own, you know, A-list domestic workers. And we got a ton of media. And we were able to, kind of what I was looking for was when people discussed Roma, they'd be like, oh, this was a fantastic film. And then their second beat would be commentary on domestic work and domestic workers. That was like our goal. Like, not just was it a powerful film, but after you say, oh, what a great piece of art, you then continue the conversation and talk about the sector, the women in real life. We accomplished that. We really did. It was beautiful.
Yeah, no, it was amazing. I mean, you all even pulled Oprah in.
Well, I will say that it's incredible how far our narrative has spread, that sometimes it is in indirect ways. That was Oprah at the Golden Globes, and also naming that, you know, she has ancestors that were domestic workers. And that was a crazy moment. We didn't know that was coming either. Hmm. When we also had, during the governor election, where Stacey Abrams was running, Barack Obama was speaking down there, and he called out domestic workers. I mean, we've had some incredible moments where we've seen high profile individuals name our movement, name domestic workers out loud. And back to Roma, Alfonso did that during the Oscars, during his acceptance speech of Best Director. He made a call out to the domestic worker movement, and that was seen by 26 million people. It's pretty big.
And the Oscar goes to Roma.
Oh yeah, I want to thank the Academy for recognizing a film centered around an indigenous woman, one of the 70 million domestic workers in the world without work rights, a character that historically had been relegated in the background in cinema.
No, absolutely, definitely a watershed moment. And I'm curious, you know, as you know, that was 2018, there was all kinds of building that, you know, to get up to that point, right? And then the work continues to try to keep the momentum going. Any lessons and sort of musings that you would like to share? A lot of the folks who we expect will listen to this will be organizers and folks building on the front lines on a variety of issues.
A couple things come to mind. So first is that there is power to it in conjunction with other strategies. I think a lot of times organizers and due to lack of capacity, which is totally understandable. So if there are funders listening, fund this work. But also because there's been less theory about culture change strategy that's, you know, kind of proliferated around the movement, and people maybe just don't think it's as important or as serious, but it should be included in your suite of strategies. And there are so many cultural organizers or narrative change practitioners who do the sort of work that would love to have a chat with you and see if they can brainstorm things with you. So if anyone listening ever wants to check in, you can always reach out to me, and I'd love to talk shop about this. But open yourself up to including this in your suite of strategies. Doesn't have to be everywhere, but somewhere, some of the places, it is the best thing that you can use at that moment, and it matters. So that would be the first thing. The second thing is to take risks, be innovative, and really put your neck out there. Just because something hasn't been done before, just because it feels a little like you are really trying something completely new and you don't know if you will be successful, still try it. And third, partnerships. Partnerships are so important. And actually that sort of relationship management is key. So many times in this work, it is a result of partnering with artists and creatives and institutions and production companies and aggregators of entertainment power, and having a really good partnership that is not transactional, but transformative, which is what iGen says, takes a lot of work. It's the same as doing great organizing, where it involves a lot of listening person to person, having one-on-ones and deep listening for each other. So you really need to invest in those partnerships. Roma would have never been as successful as it was if it wasn't for deep relationship management with participant, with Alfonso Cuarón, with the other stakeholders in their Oscar campaign. So relationships really matter in building trust. The other practitioners in this field, there are a bunch of organizations doing great work. I will always lift them up. We lift each other up and we compare notes. That is so important. And yeah, I think that those are kind of the biggest pieces of the puzzle that I would say.
Is there anything we should be looking at on the horizon that you feel like here's a trend that folks should be paying attention to in this work? I mean, you know, you guys experiment. I mean, you guys are using bots really interestingly. I mean, just all kinds of things. So I'm just curious, you know, someone who stays on the leading edge, you know, what do you see ahead that you're like, that intrigues me?
So clearly after last year, right? After Freedom Summer or the uprising, everybody calls last summer a different term, where racial justice, really the movement just reached another level due to the tragic murder of George Floyd. Companies, corporations, entertainment companies, everybody that is not in the nonprofit field is trying to do something. And we should be watching that and watching for the opportunities and also the areas where we are losing ground or could lose ground, and we need to set the agenda. And what I mean by that specifically in terms of culture change, entertainment companies are building out their departments, their in-house departments, whether they call it multicultural marketing or multicultural audience development, or some just use diversity and inclusion. Some, you know, they're all, jobs are being built, and movement should advise and what that looks like when it comes to creative content, and be mindful of that and continue to have a relationship with these folks. And it is a good thing that companies are trying to do better, in particular those who reach millions of people through their stories. But we should also be present and in the room and talking as these new people are onboarded, or some organizers apply for those jobs and get in there. So I am definitely watching that for opportunities. I would also say that it moves so quickly. Social media moves so quickly. We're all well aware of the power of social media. We will not forget Cambridge Analytica or everything else that has happened. So I am always watching where people are moving. 4 years ago when I started, NDWA didn't have a Instagram account. Now it is one of our most important platforms. So even though I'm getting older, I do have a TikTok account. I do not post, but I definitely watch. I'm a lurker. And we did our first TikTok activation this year for our Care Can't Wait campaign. We are campaigning right now for Congress to pass a care infrastructure bill that includes investments in home and community-based services, paid leave, and childcare. So we said, let's go to TikTok. We're going to create a jingle. We literally created a jingle and had influencers on TikTok create videos. So I'm definitely looking at all the new platforms and seeing where people are congregating. Even if we don't have capacity to build our own NDWA account, we can use micro-influencers, which is another thing I'll name. Micro-influencers. Definitely look into micro-influencers. And what I mean by that is you don't always need Oprah. Oprah's great, but like Oprah's not really accessible. And also it can be just as impactful if you find a trusted messenger who has a really devoted audience that listens to them and engages with them. And they have, you know, 20,000 followers, but those followers have a huge engagement with them and listen to them and trust them. And these people reinforce one another's narratives. So it's very much a fishbowl instead of kind of like a microphone going out. So the messages are more likely to stick if you hear them multiple times. So definitely look into micro-influencers and invest in them and participate with them and create creative partnerships. You don't have to always create your own channel. You can use other people's channels. You can borrow other people's audiences, which is a tactic I really love. So those are some of the things I'm thinking about right now.
That's all great. And thank you so much. Awesome, awesome, awesome. So I really super appreciate your time, your brilliance, the energy, the sharing. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I love this. I love talking about all this, and I cannot wait to listen.
I can tell. And I think it's going to help so many people, you know, because you guys' work is just absolutely brilliant and just what we need. So thank you for that.
Yay! Narrative power, we're doing it. We can all do it together.
This podcast series was directed and produced by Makani Temba and produced by the Rios Company with support from the California Endowment. Love and gratitude to all of our amazing guests. Our thanks to musicians Nate and Hilla for permission to use an excerpt from their awesome Defund the Police rap. The song is featured in our Movement Lessons episode. Special shout out to Rochelle Palin at Keddy Studio for her leadership and stewardship of this initiative. Learn more about our guests and the ideas discussed in the series by following the links that accompany each episode at www.bnpower.org. That's the letter B, like boy, and N, like Nairobi, power.org.